Yeah, good morning, everybody. So I will do the talk on the blackboard and basically do it slowly. Feel free to interrupt me whenever you have questions. In case any experimentalist is in the audience, I should say, this talk will be as exciting for an experimentalist as is the latest development on silicon detector, vertex detectors for theorists. Both are, of course, needed, so there is a motivation for this talk. And basically, the motivation is here. So we need basically, let's say, for higher loop precision calculation, we need the loop integrals. And if you think about an L loop, find an integral. We usually do it in dimensional regularization. Then, what we really want to do is basically get the Laurent expansion in the dimensional regularization parameter. So basically, it starts as basically with has poles up to 2L, goes to infinity, then you get some coefficients, and here basically epsilon is your dimensional regularization parameter. And the question I would like to ask, basically, is the following. Basically, what transcendental functions occur in these coefficients CJ? This is the first question. And the second question, can we systematically compute the CJ, starting with the, basically with the poles and then going all the way up to, let's say, can we find an algorithm which in principle allows us, given sufficient computer resources, to compute the 10,000th term in the Laurent expansion there. Can we systematically compute?
This is for loop diagrams with how many legs? Does it depend anyway, or?
As many as you like.
So you can say the set of functions is the same regardless.
Yeah. Yeah. So the first question is basically a question, is basically what objects we are talking about. And the second question is a question about what algorithms manipulate those objects. So an important class, which I think should be mentioned here, are the multiple polylogarithms. And here we immediately see, to your question, how many legs, you will immediately see that this does not put any restriction on the legs. So these I can define in several ways. I can define them as a sum representation. They have a bunch of indices, k indices, which are integer numbers. They have k arguments, x1 to xk, and they are defined basically by a sum, n1 bigger than n2, bigger than nk, and the last one is also bigger than 0. And then you just get x1 to the power n1 divided by n1 to the power of m1, and k copies of that, xk to the power nk divided by nk to mk. So if you just basically, let's say, have two legs, let's say, okay, where can I? If you have a 2-to-2 process, the only dimensional variable in Maxwell's theory is s over t. This can be 1x, so you will only have 1x. If you have 2-to-3, like e plus e minus to 3 jets, you will have two different axes, and basically 1 minus x and these combinations. So your axes get bigger and bigger. I mean, the alphabet gets bigger and bigger as the more legs you add. There's a second way to define the multiple polylogarithms. You can do it the following way. It's an integral representation. This is basically a nested sum. You can also write down a nested integral. where basically each integration goes just to the boundary of the previous one. And let's say that the last set is not equal to zero in this definition here. Here, basically, one variable is redundant. You have a scaling relation. If you multiply every variable by a non-zero constant, lambda, perform a chain of substitution, you will realize from this integral representation it's the same function again without the lambda. So in principle, you can always put the y equal to 1 with the help of this relation here. If you see this definition for the first time, it's not obvious that they define the same functions. But if you, to get from here to here and vice versa, you first introduce some shorthand notation. I mean, here you have a string of sets and no indices. So the first thing, you have to define something with indices. And this is just the notation, because it turns out that if you work with this integral representation, many of the sets are zero. So this occurs quite often. So basically, the convention is instead of writing here basically 0, 0, 0, then something non-zero, just count the number of zeros which occur before a non-zero element, and that's the number m1 minus 1. So m1 is the number of zeros plus the first non-zero element. So that is g 0, 0, 0, 0. And then comes the first non-zero one. And these are basically here m1 minus 1. And then comes again 0, 0, 0. And then comes zk minus 1, 0, 0, 0, zk. And then comes the y. And here, basically, this is mk minus 1. So this is just the convention, basically. Instead of having to write a bunch of zeros, which occur frequently, I just write indices, nothing else. But then I can basically write down the relation between these two functions. Basically, this is m1 to mk. x1 to xk is nothing else than minus 1 to the power k. So there's a minus sign. G, m1. Mk, and then the arguments basically are the inverse of 1 over x1, and then the running products 1 over x1, x2, up to 1 over x1, x2, to xk. And then, of course, we need the y, the 1. So, now, this is an important class, and basically there are certain integrals, you can start with one loop integrals, two loop integrals, which you can compute basically the Laurent expansion to arbitrary order, and the only functions, the transcendental function which occur here, are these. In order to show that this is the case, there are various methods to do that. If you would have asked me 15 years ago, I would have said, well, we have a method which is called nested sums. We are basically write for the integral with the help of Mellon Barnes. First, basically a generalization of a hypergeometric function, and then systematically expand this integral in any order in epsilon. So this is a method to achieve that. That was done with Sven Moch and Peter Huber together. Francis Brown and later Eric Panzer basically have a method which is called linear reducibility, where they basically look at the Feynman parameter integrations, and if they find a method that they somehow can choose an iteration that each integration is just an integration over a linear factor, then they are also in business. And then they also can do these things.
The last revision you wrote, I was meant to see that this works or to believe it?
Believe it.
If
you want to see that, basically, this 1 over t1 minus z1 expanded as a geometric series integrated.
Okay.
That is basically the proof. Here, just believe me.
Okay.
The last method to show that certain integrals can be expanded to arbitrary order in these functions is basically the method of differential equations. That was pioneered by Kotikov, later basically for E plus E minus 2 3 jets. Vittore Rinidi and Thomas German used this method. And basically the last final touch bar was by Johannes Hahn, basically who showed that you can always write it down basically in a certain way that basically the inhomogeneous term is proportional to epsilon. And basically I will be using basically the method of differential equations what comes now. I should also say basically that these functions, if you differentiate them, basically for instance d dy of a g z1 zk y, this is very simple. It gives you a simpler function with one argument less. Basically, it's just a rational prefactor 1 over y minus z2, and then the g, which starts with z2, zk, and y. So this is a very simple differential equation. It's a first order inhomogeneous differential equation. So these are the things which I'm not talking about today. Great. So I told you that several integrals, basically every coefficient can be expressed in this class of function. And actually what I would like to say, if you just think about a one loop integral, a box, you will see these functions here and you learn already a lot of the function class. And this function class is then also relevant to higher loop calculations. You will need basically the first epsilon to the one coefficient. You would say, well, that I might need if I do a next to leading order calculation. You learn about the function class here, so you already get a glimpse what you would expect in the double box. So this is not just an academic exercise. Expanding, being able to expand these things to high order gives you useful information already about integrals you do not start with. So now comes the bad news. As I said before, basically not every integral can be expressed in these functions, and there are integrals which go beyond. So the simplest integral, a Feynman integral, which cannot be expressed in multiple polylogs, and the simplest counterexample is a two-loop sunrise integral with non-zero masses. It's basically this one. Yeah, basically, the three masses are non-zero, and here basically you have a momentum flowing in there. So now I give you the executive summary of my talk here. That's good news. You can compute this integral to all orders in epsilon if you enlarge the class slightly. And it's basically just you need to add a few more functions. Can be computed to all orders in epsilon add functions. So already here you have a bunch of indices, a bunch of arguments. It does not get better. No? So we call these functions, we put an E before for elliptic. So the indices N1, 2, and L. L is just tells you the number of indices, has nothing to do with the loops. So it's basically something like this, a string like that. Then you get another copy, I call the M's, as many as before, okay, of indices. And then you get another copy I call them O's. Here one less. And I put a 2 in front just for convention. So then you get arguments. X1 to XL, okay, as here, corresponding to these indices. Then you get arguments at Y1 to YL, corresponding to the second copy here, okay? And then you get an argument Q, and that Q I will explain later. So, bunch of indices, bunch of arguments here. Looks pretty complicated. So what is this? I define it as a sum, basically, sum summation index, J1 from 1 to infinity to JL from 1 to infinity. That's basically summation over those. Then a bunch of summation for the next copy. Let's call them K1 from 1 to infinity to KL from 1 to infinity. Okay, that's for the summations. Basically, we have 2L summations here. Then what do we get? We get basically building blocks like here over there. So it's a x1 to the power j1, j1 to the power n1, xl to the power jl, jl to the power nl. So basically, these pair of indices, these pair of arguments, basically, it's the same as here. Okay? Then you get the same thing for the y's. It's basically a y1 to, now it's a k1, divided a k1 to the m1, yl to the kl, divided by a kl to the ml. Okay? If I just would leave it like that, basically, you would say, what I write down, it's a product of classical polylogs of steps 1, basically, polylog LIN1 from X1 times LIN2 of X2, and so on. It's not a nested sum, basically, each sum goes individually from 1 to infinity, it's just basically exact, it's just a product of 2L classical polylogs, okay? Then we would be, of course, in this class of functions. So now comes basically the thing which takes you out of this class of functions, that these integrations are not independent, and they are coupled by a new variable, Q, which basically goes, so here comes a Q, and it couples the J1, K1 in the exponent, plus J2, K2, blah, 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 plus J, KL. Okay? So these couple the summation together. And then we still need these indices O's down here. So the indices O down there is basically here's a J1. You have some down in the denominator. So you get basically C things down in the denominator. So, and what you get basically, sometimes you just get basically, you get the full thing. Then you get basically the thing starting at 2 to L, then from 3 to L, and so on. So I can write that basically as I from 1 to L1 minus 1, JI, KI, and then it goes all the way to JL, KL, and then to the power OI. So that's it. You can now ask, if you very carefully understand the definition from the first time I write it down, why did I not put an index 2OL here? Well, 2OL, what would it do? It would just basically give some factor here, which is just a JL times a KL to the power OL. So I could add this factor basically here to the last ones. So this would be redundant. That's the reason why that one is not there.
And the O's, are they integers or half integers? Or?
In our case, they are integers.
Okay.
You can also take some. There are always integers here. The reason why we put the 2 here is basically somehow a power counting. Let's say each factor of j and k counts as weight 1. Here you always have 2 down there. So each o counts as 2. So basically we have a naive definition of a weight, which is just the sum of the indices here.
In the multiple polylogarithm, your n's were somehow nested.
Right. Correct.
Here
they're not. That's the way it is. So I will tell something about that in the end. In some sense, these functions are simpler than what I would have expected. Because they are just, I mean, this factor here ties together these classical polylogs. But we haven't seen yet the nested structure.
So, is this supposed to be a subset of those or not?
No, because you don't have the nested ones here. What I say basically is the class of function is that one plus that one. As
but if you go to the cusp, if you go send q to I infinity, do you recover the polylogs or not? And not q to I infinity, tau to I infinity.
Tau to infinity means q equals to 0, so it goes to 0.
So there is no, I would have, maybe again, you're the expert. I would have expected that when I take my elliptic curve and I make the hole close, I go to the spheres.
I will, let's postpone this question for 10 minutes. I will show you exactly what happens there at the cusp.
In this executive summary that you made, this applies to the sunset diagrams?
Exactly.
At 2 loop. Or at any loop.
It's a 2 loop integral. Expanded and
now, this I do understand, but with arbitrary masses inside, because you also wrote MMM.
Now, with equal masses.
Okay.
I would say we have good chances that it also holds for arbitrary masses.
Okay. But really for the thing that you drew down.
Now, for the talk here, I don't want to write basically pages of formulas here. I just do equal masses. And it's basically, if you expand that thing...
No, I get it.
Can you say something about, more interesting diagrams where these new functions appear? I mean, the sunset, okay, fine. One way or the other. What is the condition for these objects to appear?
Let me go on. This is an interesting question, actually. That's exactly what we are doing right now. I will tell you what the non-trivial point about that thing is. So.
Can I just, one more question. This reminds me a little bit of this Q generalization of the hypergeometric function. For example, if you set Q to 1.
Yes, it also reminds me a little bit of that. Although I haven't.
Isn't it exactly that? I mean.
No.
It's like a hypergeometrical function of a particular kind of many variables, right? With this addition of the parameter. If you set it to 1, it's exactly.
Well, there is a precise way how you deform an ordinary hypergeometric function basically by replacing the Pochhammer by the Q factorial. It's not that. How it is related, I haven't figured out yet. I would expect it has something to do, yes. But it's not that I can write down, it's like that. I would not say it's unrelated, but let's just say I don't know the exact relation. Question from Kirill, basically. Under which conditions do you expect these things? So let's now really look at this integral here, this sunset integral. I put some scale in front of it to make it dimensionless. Okay, it's the standard measure to get rid of all pi's which are around. And basically the propagators, I take everyone with a minus sign. just have equal masses. That's the sunset integral. Each propagator occurs to the power 1. And of course, you can write it in Feynman parameterization. You get two graph polynomials, and they occur basically to the power 3 minus 3 half d and 3 minus d. So what are the graph polynomials? Well, the first one is very simple. And the second one is also not particularly complicated. And here I said basically t. This is a variable I will use very often. It's just p squared. Basically, this momentum here coming in and out. So now think about what happens basically in two dimensions. In two dimensions, basically, the exponent of the first graph polynomial is 0. And the exponent of that one, 3 minus 2, is 1. So this is a particular nice situation. Basically, you only have the dependence on one graph polynomial. And basically, the other one you can treat somehow as a perturbation. So this is the reason, basically, why we calculate this integral around two dimensions. We said, basically, d gleich 2 minus 2 epsilon. Then basically, we have mu squared 1 plus 2 epsilon, gamma from 1 plus 2 epsilon, d three x. And then we have u to the power 3 epsilon and f to the power 1 plus 2 epsilon. And in particular for, now, you can also show that this integral is finite. So there are no infrared divergences because you have the masses, and basically in two dimensions there are no ultraviolet divergences. So this is completely finite. So in that case, the Laurent expansion starts with epsilon 2 to the power 0. So that's the first non-zero term. And you can say, well, I don't care about two dimensions, but there are well-known relations how you get from two dimensions to four dimensions by Tarasov, and you can use them once you have the result in two dimensions to get your result in four dimensions. For the calculation to be able to show that you can compute everything, it's much simpler to do it in two dimensions. So, as I said, basically, for e equals 2, integrand is simply 1 over f.
There's no reason. I mean, why not do it in d equals 3 to get rid of the denominator?
Because then you would just probe the ultraviolet part. The most complicated part of the integral is the infrared stuff, which has the masses inside, the kinematical information. So u is just a final parameter. It gives you a multiple zeta value. Give it to a student in your master classes.
But don't want to start with something that is trivial.
But also, you can't go from 3 to 4.
Okay, so that's that.
So basically, doing it in two dimensions isolates the really complicated part and gets rid of anything else which you know how to deal with. Let's put it like that. So, next thing, where is the elliptic curve? I put elliptic in the title. So where's the elliptic curve? It's basically here. F equals 0 defines an elliptic curve. F is a polynomial of degree 3 in the Feynman parameters. It's basically a cubic or a quartic polynomial basically in a plane is basically an elliptic curve. So I would like to explain what this Q is. I didn't do that yet. So then you take basically your favorite book from a mathematician on elliptic curves. There are plenty of them. And say, well, there's something like the Weierstrass normal form. So instead of working in the coordinates x1, x2, x3, well, you can always put one coordinate to one. I mean, choose a chart in this Feynman parameter space. Let's say x3 equals to 1. You just have x1 and x2. Then you can make a transformation to bring it in a standardized form, this elliptic curve, which is called the Weierstrass normal form. So you rewrite that basically in the form y squared equals a cubic polynomial in x, and I factorize this polynomial e1 x minus e2 minus x minus e3. So this factor 4 is a convention by Weierstrass, and e1, e2, e3 are the roots of this cubic polynomial, and you can work them out. Once you have this Weierstrass normal form, you can define something which is called periods of an elliptic curve. And basically, you define basically the first period, factor of 2, and then you take with these variables dx over y. This dx over y, mathematicians call the holomorphic one form of the elliptic curve. And you basically integrate it between two pairs of the roots. Let's say what I take, basically e2 and e3. And you define a second period. Also, you integrate this holomorphic one form, and now between e1 and e3. It does not really matter, basically, which roots you take. Basically, whatever you take, you get a linear combination of these two. You just should not take basically two which are linear dependent. So this basically defines what I take for my conventions. And basically, you can work out these integrals. They give you some algebraic prefactor times a complete elliptic integral of the first kind. So this is something algebraic times complete elliptic integral. So you can think about an elliptic curve also as a torus, basically. And then these periods, basically some tune-up like that. And then these periods are really basically the integration over basically these two cycles here. Another way of thinking about an elliptic curve is basically the complex plane modulo a lattice. And then the periods are just the lattice vectors which define your lattice. Basically, C modulo lattice, basically you have here's a complex plane, and then you have basically two basic vectors, C1 and C2, and then you basically get here this fundamental cell, this parallel. So, the ratio of the two periods defined here is called basically the moduli of the elliptic curve. It's usually called tau. It's basically the ratio psi1 over psi2. And then, now I can tell you what this Q is. It's related basically to this tau. Q is called the norm. It's e to the I pi tau. also a standard definition in the theory of elliptic curves.
And this Q,
basically defined here, basically through this period here, is exactly the Q which appears here. Okay?
I mean, what is the kinematics that we are in? Is it arbitrary? Is P squared less than, I don't know, 9 M squared? Or
basically, what we do, we calculate everything around P squared equals 0. Of course, you get a threshold at 9 M squared. So basically, we derive functions which are basically derived in the region around P squared equals 0. And then you can think about analytically continuing through the threshold. Spencer Bloch and Pierre van Hove, they basically, what they also work on this subject. What they do, they derive formulas around P squared equals infinity. You can do, in principle, you have to make a choice. Basically, that's what I will show you. You solve differential equation, you put in some boundary conditions. For the boundary conditions, it is useful to take a point where the elliptic curve is degenerate. Degeneracies where basically occur at t equals 0, at the threshold, at infinity. So these are the canonical choices for the boundaries. And that's where you start to calculate. OK?
What about this tau? Is it a number? Is it, what kind of a number is it?
It's a complex number with imaginary part not equal to 0. I can tell you basically t equals 0 corresponds to tau gleich I infinity to q equals 0.
Is it a number or a function? It's a function of p squared over m squared, right?
It's a function of what? Of p squared, yes. Basically, what the mathematicians do, they always say, well, this tau basically, it's basically here in the strip, basically, here's a unit circle, and that is basically 1/2 away from the axis, I think.
So, at which point did you need three masses to be non-vanishing? So suppose two masses are zero and one mass is not zero.
In that case, basically, what will happen is that this elliptic curve does not look like a torus, but looks like a degenerate torus. So you have basically a vanishing period here.
And then somehow these functions degenerate and become normal.
Then you get to the ordinary polylogs. Basically, whenever one mass goes to zero, basically you don't have a generic elliptic curve anymore. You have to degenerate one, and then everything becomes simpler. So, let's write down the differential equation, and I choose some master integrals. I chose basically three master integrals, two related to the sunrise, and one master integral basically where one propagator is pinched, basically a product of tadpoles. So let's start with the tadpole, and basically what I choose is some prefactor 1 over 2 plus epsilon. I choose a t over m squared to the power 2 epsilon, and then m squared over mu squared squared. And then basically the tadpole in, not in 2 minus 2 epsilon dimension, but 2 dimensions less, so 0 minus 2 epsilon dimensions. Okay, anyway, tadpoles are trivial, basically. This is basically an integral like that. The second master integral is basically the integral I'm interested in. Again, t m squared to the power 2 epsilon m squared mu squared just to the power 1. And then basically this integral in 2 minus 2 epsilon dimensions. So this is this one here. And the second master, third master integral, I choose basically again this prefactor here, t to the 2 epsilon m squared over mu squared. And then I choose basically an integral which has a propagator raised, again in d gleich 2 minus 2 epsilon dimension. Does not matter which one because they all have equal masses, so it would be that one. Here. So, then I have a differential equation, and the differential equation for the sunset integral is already known for a very long time. Basically, it was worked by Brodhaus beginning of the 90s, Ettore Remedi and Stefano Laporta in the mid 90s wrote it down for all d. So, this differential equation is known for a very long time. And I write it down in the following way, basically inspired by our new colleague in Mainz from Johannes, basically, to write it down in a canonical form. Basically, so these three master integrals give a matrix times the master integrals again. So, and what is this matrix? Basically, this matrix is mu squared over t and 2 epsilon 0, 0 minus 1, 1 fourth, 1 plus 2 epsilon, 0 minus 4, 1 plus 3 epsilon, 1 plus 5 epsilon, plus mu squared t minus 9 m squared, and then 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0 minus 3, 1 plus 3 epsilon, minus 1 minus 2 epsilon. And here, basically, mu squared t minus m squared, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 3, 3 plus 9 epsilon, minus 1, minus 2 epsilon. That's it. So what you see, basically, the kinematic information, the poles, are factored out. And then I have matrices which just have integer rational numbers. So if you know the canonical form from Johannes, you would say, I spot a difference. In the canonical form of Johannes, everything would be proportional to epsilon. Here, it's not. So this is the fact that we are not in the polylog business. If it would be proportional to epsilon, then the epsilon to the zero terms in the matrices would be absent. But otherwise, it's exactly the same. So you get the epsilon 0, epsilon 1, linear and epsilon. And basically, you have basically the poles, which are the singularities of the differential equations, the threshold, the pseudo-threshold, and the differential equation has also a singularity at t equals 0.
So if you have three different masses, then how many terms should be there? I mean, how many poles in the t minus some?
Well, you still have the threshold, but then basically the pseudo-threshold, you not only have one. Basically, you get basically M1 plus M2 minus M3, and the three other combinations that you get. And there might be some other poles related where the Vronskian vanish. I'm not sure if there are. I would have to work it out. So there might be two other singularities that I cannot tell at the moment. OK, but otherwise, it's a differential equation with these matrices here. Now, what you do with that And now the next trick is change variable from t. So this is the variable where we wrote down our differential equation. This is a good variable for physicists. No? Tells you where the threshold is. It's a momentum which flows in and out of the sunrise integral. But mathematicians would say, well, takes this q. Q is the norm of the elliptic curve. And this change of variable is essential. And it goes back, basically, the first one who proposed it were Bloch, a mathematician, and Van Hove. A posteriori, I can also say, basically, what happens is, basically, I would like to see these functions here. What happens is everything is multiplied by psi 1 over pi. So this is basically just a generalization of pi somehow. And psi 1 is basically the solution of the homogeneous differential equations. And that's always there, so let's say factor it out. So that's the next thing we do, factor out. This is just a prefactor, basically. And basically say, okay, T, S, and S2, we write it basically, we factor out this period, and then write it as F, E, and E2. Okay? So, now, you do this change of variables, what you get is Q, D, DQ. Now, in your new integrals, this F, E, and E2, is basically 1 over I pi mu squared psi 1 squared over the Vronskian times A minus d log psi 1 over d log q and then f e. And W is a Vronskian. So now you say, okay, does not look really simpler, no? So I have the Vronskian in it, I have this period in it, and this derivative, what did I gain? Well, the trick is that now we change the variables from T to Q, and we express everything which appears here in the new variable q. And let's see what we get. So that I can erase here. So what I get is basically here is again my matrix A. I don't have to worry about basically the integers and rational function, rational numbers here. What is essential is this 1 over t here, this is 1 over t minus 9m squared, and so on. So let's say what is 1 over I pi psi 1 squared divided by the Vronskian 1 over t. So that would be the first term here. Now, this, if you express everything in Q, is 1 minus 4 Eli from 0 minus 1 from R3 minus 1 minus Q minus 4 Eli 0 minus 1 R3 to the power minus 1 minus 1. Minus q. And R3 is the third root of unity. Okay?
This is the relationship between t and q.
Yes. If you make this change of variables, the basic message is that you get everything nicely in these functions. Yeah.
Sorry, Stefan. Of course, with generalizations to, you know, any kind of problem in mind. How do you find these relations in practice, right? I mean, in this case, I guess if you work, maybe you can spot it somehow, but in general, is it evident how to
this do is exactly the non-trivial point. This is exactly, basically, here, basically, it's somehow clear. You just have a single elliptic curve. It's a variable q that I can understand. And then you just try to find an expression. What we do, basically, we make an ansatz, guess what it could be, expand everything in q to the power 100, and see if it fits or not. And then I mean, you can expand it to the power 100, 200. That is all feasible. And then I'm quite confident that these relations are correct. And but I must admit, I have no understanding how to do it constructively at the moment. And this is exactly the point which stops us from going to more complicated things. But somehow it tells you what to expect. And this basically, this change of variable is a non-trivial piece in the whole story. And basically, you can do the same thing for this term, and for that term. Basically, you find, basically, okay, here you have a constant, and then the EVs is 0 and minus 1. All the other terms here, they just have the EVs, no constant. All other expressions. Just Ely, no, minus 1, some x, some y, and some minus q. Under some, over some, with some coefficients, which are integers or rational numbers. Okay. Now, this is now already very good, because now next thing, can start to solve the differential equation exactly in two dimensions. That was already done previously, basically 1.5 years ago, and you find basically that you can write this expression basically as this prefactor, which we factored out, here, times 3 over I, 1/2 dialog of the third root of unity minus 1/2 dialog third root of unity the inverse plus Ely 2, 0, R3, minus 1, minus Q, minus Ely 2, 0, R3, minus 1, minus 1, minus Q. This answers the question you raised 20 minutes ago. It's basically how basically does it go when I take t equals to 0? T equals to 0 basically means q equals to 0. So these terms then go to 0. What remains here is basically just these two dialogues.
My question was slightly different. Because you would have expected these functions. Well, I know that my normal polynomial span, my iterated integrals on and so on. And just as I understood from Francis' paper, the elliptic generalization span integrals on M1. And so from this, it looks more like that.
Wait.
Something which is.
Okay. There might be a relation, but I'm not saying that the sunrise integral for all orders in epsilon can be expressed in terms of what Francis Brown defines. As the polylogs on M1n. Because, why? What is the difference? M1n is just the moduli space of a genus 1 surface, or an elliptic curve. I erased it. What I told you, basically, at this zero order, this is basically, you can rewrite it basically as an elliptic polylog defined by Francis Brown plus some junk that we can do. Now, if you look at the formula for the sunrise integral, which I erased here, you know, you still see it, you have basically this other Feynman-Kraft polynomial here. In higher order terms, it contributes. This is a genus zero. It has nothing to do with this genus one down there. So basically what we need are functions which somehow need know about the genus one here and the genus zero there. So it's not a poor genus one thing, what we compute here. It must know about the U as well.
Here you have strictly two, so then...
Yeah, here you basically, this expression you can rewrite basically as an elliptic dialogue defined by Francis Brown. I should say that various mathematicians define elliptic polylogs in a different way. You have to go, basically the relation between them always involves some chunk terms. There's a definition by Francis Brown, which you can basically rewrite this expression here, and that's a, this bracket here is an elliptic dialogue defined by Spencer Bloch, another mathematician. In the end, basically, whom you like more.
So you're saying that these things are, strictly speaking, not the elliptic polylogs as mathematicians would define them?
They are not the things what Francis Brown defines. They are basically the natural things if you would like to compute these integrals. Yeah, I think that I would claim. Okay. And I think the reason is that I'm not working strictly on M1n, but I have the second Kraft polynomial, which I should take into account. I must say that I don't completely understand the issue, so this is certain a point which should be clarified. But taking a pragmatic view, basically these are basically functions which resemble very close the polylogs I started with. So I think it's a good working thing. So let me say the last thing, to see why these functions basically allow you to basically obtain the all order result iteratively. It's basically, okay, this thing you can prove solves the order epsilon to the power zero equation. Just put epsilon to zero here, plug it in, verify it. Okay? Now what happens? If you calculate the next order in epsilon from this differential equation, basically you get a contribution which is just the zero order result, another copy of it, plus the terms which you had already in the previous order, which come with this epsilon here. Okay. So this differential equation, if you integrate it, you integrate dq over q times what is on the right-hand side. So basically, what you have to integrate, basically the new integrations, you get dq over q. Then these terms which are in here, they are all of this form here, the Elis. Eli 0 minus 1. X1, Y1, minus Q. And then you get basically what you had basically in the next lowest order from this term here. So,
sorry, what is X1 and Y1?
The X's are usually third roots of unities, third roots of unity to the power minus 1 or 1, something like that. And the Y's are usually 1 and minus 1, in this case at hand here. Doesn't really matter. And then basically, by induction, basically, the previous order can be expressed in terms of functions. So you get basically some Eli, let's say N2 up to NL, M2 up to ML, and then 2O2 up to 2OL minus 1, and then the arguments X2, Y2, minus Q. So, now this class of functions basically allows you to do this integration. You don't get out of this class of functions. function. Because what happens, you integrate over dq over q, basically you get here some q to the power product of two summation indices. And here, basically, you have the q in this form here, starting with j2. So what it does, it combines basically the two exponents and brings down one factor of it. So basically, the whole thing is just an AD where you add the 0 to the n's. So 0 n2 to nl. You add the minus 1 to the m's, m2, ml. And then it brings down basically one factor where you basically have j1 and k1 in the beginning. So this gives you basically a 2 here, and then basically just the rest. And then basically you add the x1 to the x's, x2, xl. You add the y1 to the y's, and then you get minus q. And that goes on for every order you like to calculate. You always stay inside this class of function. So that basically is a proof why you can express the Sundrize integral in terms of these functions. I should say I have cheated a very little bit here. And the cheat is basically this one here, where you have to be a little bit more careful, because when you integrate basically and assume basically that also you integrate that one with a constant piece here, then you get basically a simple integration dq over q. If you start from 0, it's infinity, but this is the usual story with the polynomials and trailing zeros. And you treat it exactly the same fashion. So it's a technical complication, but no showstopper. So, yeah, that's it.
You presented this function in terms of, you know, this nested sums, but what if you try to think in terms of, you know, nested integrals rather? Wouldn't that be more, I don't know, at least I would imagine it's better.
You can write down the nested integral representation in this form here, this integration over Q. It's equivalent.
So what would be the equivalent of the 1 over z minus z1, etc. in that case?
Let's put it like that. We have a trivial integral representation as an integration over Q. What we do not have is as an integral representation as integration over x or integration over the y's. Okay? And that's basically what you are asking for. I don't know. What's the difference?
Except insofar as your representation involves this Li.
But in the end, basically, we use an integral representation in terms of Q.
Yes. So how does this elliptic Hadamard function transform onto the marginal transformation?
For example, they are not invariant.
Not invariant. Okay. So if you consider some kind of monodromy of this kind of kinematics, for example, you take t very small, closing to zero, and take a circle around zero, then how does the integrated result change?
I haven't checked. The monodromy, no.
The monodromy.
They are not modular invariants, that I am sure, which was already in a paper by Bloch and Van Hove.
Another question. If you consider total diagram, long planar case with some massive legs, okay, do you have some version of the hyper-elliptic hyperlogs?
No. Didn't think about it yet. Do you?
I mean, they would appear there, of course.
I want to ask the following. So what is really the difference between sort of you know, the differential equation that gives you normal contour forwards on this. I mean, it seems to me that somehow, from what I see, okay, the canonical form doesn't vanish if epsilon goes to zero, fine, but what this really means is that somehow write your leading order differential equation, I mean, the matrix that enters the leading order differential equation contains already these non-trivial functions.
Right.
Is this what it is?
Yeah. Okay. Of course, now I got brainwashed by Johannes. Huh?
Yeah.
The way we wrote it in the paper was slightly different. Basically, what maybe that makes it more clear, the answer to your question.
Mm-hmm.
If I just have polylogs, I'm sure that you can always find a first-order differential equation with an inhomogeneous term.
Yeah,
this inhomogeneous term is just some lower stuff.
Yeah.
The important thing is it's first order for a single integral. Now here, if I write it another way, is basically if you just consider this integral, you can write down a second order differential equation, which does not factor into linear factors. It's an irreducible differential operator. And that is a new thing. It's an irreducible second-order differential operator, which acts on this single integral and gives you then basically a differential equation with an inhomogeneous term. This is the difference. In the polylog case, this differential operator would factorize into linear factors some way or other.
So when you look at a given integral or a diagram, the corresponding diagram, what is that, when do you know that you have to enlarge the family of functions that you are considering from the multiple polylogs or to the elliptic or multiple polylogs? For instance, you said answering one of these questions that if you set 2s to 0, you go back to the multiple polylogs. So what is that tells you when you have to move a step ahead and therefore, if you pick any diagram you come up with, when do you know that maybe this is not it?
I cannot give you a precise answer, but as a guess, I would say whenever your diagram contains basically a sub-diagram which you obtain by contracting lines, which is this diagram here, I would expect that you have to enlarge your class. I would be very surprised if you don't have to do that. This is probably, there are also diagrams where I think, which is a little bit more tricky, it's a 10-point two-loop functions in massless theories, where people also expect, basically, this diagram here looks very symmetric, 10 external points, everything massless. Here, basically, if you look basically at the discontinuities, you also get a root of a cubic polynomial. So also there, people expect basically elliptic stuff in this diagram here. Also, it's completely massless. So these are basically the two cases where I would say you would expect something.
Thank you very much, Stefan.